Not only is the community of Mount Vernon, New Hampshire, proud of their upscale colonial town, they also take pride in their long-standing history of being a tight-knit community where the 2,000 residents look out for one another in the unlikely event a crime should take place. And in one small rural neighbourhood lived the Cates family, who shared this unspoken mutual agreement to look out for one another. Each property in the neighbourhood was set on plenty of land, so although you had a neighbour, you weren't right next door, as it were. And until October the 4th, 2009, this agreement had been super simple for everyone, as nothing out of the ordinary had ever occurred. But the Mount Vernon community was about to be shaken to its very core, never believing that something as horrific as what unfolded at number 4 Trow Road could have been possible in their peaceful hometown. Hey Coffee and Crimers, I'm your host, Belle Fagan. Just before meeting her husband, Kimberly had graduated from nursing school in Tucson, Arizona. Her and David Cates married in 1997 and welcomed a daughter named Jamie Lynn a year later. Nursing was truly Kimberly's calling, so as soon as she felt that Jamie Lynn was old enough, she got a job as a nurse, perfect for her loving and caring nature. With a move to Baltimore in between, the family of three eventually relocated and settled in the idyllic setting of Mount Vernon, New Hampshire in 2004. David Cates worked for the company BAE Systems as an engineer and often would travel for work. And by often, I mean sometimes upward of 26 times a year. And the weekend of October 4th, 2009 was one of those away times. Along with the mutual agreement to look out for one another, like I said, with their neighbours, they also had a home security system. Because, yeah, they did live in this little slice of heaven, but they were originally from big cities, so it was just in their nature to be a little bit more cautious, unlike a lot of their neighbours who had grown up in the area and didn't even lock their doors at night. Their alarm was one of those that immediately alert police if it goes off, so neither Kimberly nor David were ever worried when he went on these trips. Except, on the day that he left for this business trip, their home security system malfunctioned and they couldn't get it back up and running before he left. But like I said, they reminded themselves that this was a nice area and they had people that Kimberly and Jamie could call on. So although the couple were aware of the malfunction, the dozens of drama-free weekends that David had been out of town meant that they just weren't worried. So David happily left for his trip. What neither David or Kimberly could know was that their small neighbourhood was about to be the target of four sadistic teens looking to make a quick buck burglarising with the agreement that nothing and no one would get in their way, meaning that they would kill anyone that they came across during the process. The weekend began with nothing out of the ordinary. 42-year-old Kimberly texted David on the Saturday night telling him that she and Jamie were going to head to the mall the next day and possibly stop by the studio that Jamie attended for martial arts. She ended their exchange just saying goodnight and I love yous, all the normal stuff, and said that she and Jamie were going to bed. Now, more often than not, Jamie would sleep with Kimberly when David was out of town, and that night was no different. Snuggling up together, they soon fell asleep peacefully. Having selected Trow Road a couple of weeks before, due to it being isolated and down a long dirt road, 14 boys arrived at number 4. As they approached the house, 17-year-old Stephen Spader said, "Guys, we're about to do the most evil thing this town has ever seen." The other passengers were Quinn Glover, who was 17, William Marks, 18, and Christopher Gribble, 20. Together, they'd named themselves the Disciples of Destruction, a criminal brotherhood that was created by Stephen only a month before this fateful night. With a name like that, I mean, that just tells us everything we need to know about these guys, right? Chris Gribble dropped the three others off while he went to find a parking spot that they could park in for long enough that it wouldn't be spotted or later identified. He finally settled on a long dirt driveway that left plenty of space between the Cates neighbours and his car. By the time that he arrived back at the house, his buddies had already scoped it out and found an entry point, a very small window leading into the basement. Now, the basement window was super small, so if they were going to use that window, the only choice they had was to choose William Marks, known as Billy, to go in, as he weighed no more than 90 pounds at a push. So that made shimmying through that small basement window a breeze. The plan started going wrong almost immediately because Billy found himself to be in what he thought was a locked basement. In reality, the dum-dum was pushing on the door that led up to the house instead of pulling. I mean, we've all done it, okay? We've all pushed when we should pull, or we've all pulled when we should push. But even so, we're still calling him a dum-dum, okay? And panicking, he called out to the others that he was locked in the basement. So trying to move as fast as they possibly could, the three others quickly found another point of entry into the home through a living room window that had an external air conditioning unit attached to it. The boys cut the screen surrounding the unit, removed the AC, and entered the home into the living room. After rescuing Billy, if you can call it rescuing, from the basement, the boys made their way through the house slowly. It was Chris who first noticed the alarm system, and obviously they didn't realise it was broken as it still looked operational. So thinking that it was working and seeing what they thought was motion detectors, Chris decided to go back outside and cut the power to the house by flipping the breaker switch that was located out front. The first room that they entered was Jamie's bedroom. Obviously, no one was in there, but they did see an iPod and decided to use the built-in light to guide their way through the rest of the home. They made their way to the master bedroom at the back of the house, where Kimberly and Jamie were sound asleep. Stephen entered the room first and quickly told the others that there were people in there. But the boys misheard what he said and they thought he'd said, "There's no one in here." Thinking that the coast was clear, the other boys started to relax and talk louder. It was around 3 a.m. when Kimberly Cates woke from the noise and saw a dim light shining in her face. Thinking that her daughter needed her, she sat up in bed and said, "Jamie, is that you?" while trying to turn on the lamp by her bedside. Before she could even process what was happening, Stephen began stabbing Kimberly with the machete that he had brought along, swinging it like a baseball bat, fast, furious, and brutal. Even while she was being attacked, her thoughts were on Jamie. Hearing Jamie's cries, she tried to console her daughter, all while still struggling to try and defend them both from the rain of stabs, continually telling Jamie that everything was going to be okay. Kimberly suffered 32 injuries on multiple different areas of her body, and according to professionals, the wounds were caused by two different weapons, which we'll see in a minute. The wounds above her neck were so severe, her skull opened and extended to the brain, causing her brain to actually be visible. Her eyeballs were also protruding out of her skull, and her throat had been slit. According to her post-mortem results, Kimberly was alive during every single stab wound that was inflicted on her. The official determination was that even though the injuries had done irreparable damage, none of them had actually been lethal. Instead, Kimberly had bled to death. Now, if Alison Botha, back in episode 7, taught us anything, it's that slitting your throat doesn't always kill you, and I truly wish that that had been the case for Kimberly.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra,
and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Devastatingly, Jamie's injuries were just as horrifying. She'd been stabbed at the same time as her mum, but by Chris. A whole section of her left foot, including her big toe, had been amputated. She had a laceration on her cheek that extended down into her neck, and her jaw had been split open. She had lacerations on her breasts, her arms, and her legs, and a wound penetrated and lacerated Jamie's skull and was described as if you were opening a flap in a book. Her lungs were punctured and her left arm was broken. The doctors would later go on to say that Jamie had more wounds inflicted on her than anyone they had ever treated. Like I said, it'd been Chris that had attacked the terrified Jamie with the handheld knife that he'd brought along. And after hearing me tell you the injuries that she sustained, you will be shocked when I tell you that 11-year-old Jamie survived. Like, how on earth? But again, going back to Alison Botha, we shouldn't ever be surprised. This incredibly brave and smart little girl outwitted her attackers. After Chris had finished stabbing her, she flopped into his arms. So he decided to just throw her across the room into a sliding glass door. And that is where she then pretended to be dead. She lay on the ground lifeless for long enough that the boys all agreed that both Kimberly and Jamie must be dead. Well, Chris's actual words were, "Well, I figure she's toast." After her attackers left the house, she crawled to the kitchen and dialed 911. During the attack, one of the boys had actually turned the power back on, and when the lights on the house went on, Chris had described the master bedroom looking like a scene out of the TV show CSI. Stephen was covered in blood from his machete attack on Kimberly, and after he'd finished stabbing her, he had placed a pillow over Kimberly's face to put an end to her gurgling noises. And for no other reason than just because, Chris then went over to Kimberly and stabbed her in the neck 3 times, even though, like I said, he figured that she and Jamie were already dead at this point. And again, I'll reiterate, because I really do wish it was true, but like the medical examiner had reported, Kimberly Cates was alive for every stab wound that was inflicted upon her, including those final 3, all of which Jamie could hear while she laid as motionless as possible, knowing that her life depended on it. Going back to when I told you that Chris had said that Jamie was probably toast, Stephen Spader then kicked Jamie with his steel-toed boots for good measure, before saying, "Ugh, I'm bored." Believing both of his victims were dead, he was now bored because there was nothing left to do. Although the attacks had been carried out solely by Chris Gribble and Stephen Spader, Billy Marks and Quinn Glover had watched the entire ordeal from the doorway of the master bedroom and had done nothing to save the mother and daughter. So back to Jamie calling 911. The dispatcher obviously could barely make out what the severely wounded Jamie was saying, but hearing the obvious and extreme distress, police were immediately sent to the home. The responding officer circled the house, and when he reached the kitchen window, he saw Jamie severely wounded on the kitchen floor. And breaking down the door, Jamie was finally saved. Petrified and not wanting the officer to leave her side, he tried to explain to her that she was safe, but he had to go and try and help anyone else in the home that might be injured. And Jamie's response to him was heartbreaking. She said, "My mummy is in the house, but I think my mummy is already dead." Another officer arrived and took Jamie while the responding officer went back to look for Kimberly. Walking into the master bedroom, in a room essentially looking like it had been painted with blood, he found Kimberly on the bed, slaughtered. While the investigators tried to piece together what had happened in those early hours of the morning, and I say piece together because they literally had nothing. They had a tyre track left in the dirt of Troy Road and Jamie's description of it was a white man. But by now, the attackers were already back home in the nearby town of Brookline, bragging about the crime that they had just committed. And the sickening part, well, actually, it's not the sickening part, but one of the sickening parts was that their total bounty, shall we say, from the robbery element was $130. And to me, that says it was never truly about robbery. But thanks to their arrogance, they essentially all but delivered themselves to the authorities. After sleeping off their crime for a few hours, Chris went and pawned the $130 worth of goods that they had taken from the Cates, and then he and Stephen had gone over to a friend's house. And according to one report, their confession to murdering what they thought was both the mother and daughter was to their friend Kyle Fenton, simply saying, "Yeah, we killed that kid and her mum last night." What they didn't know was that Kyle's mum had overheard this bragging, and she immediately alerted authorities and all four teens were brought in for questioning. As it turned out, both of these goons had been making their rounds, boasting to a lot of their friends about the killings, and instead of being impressed, several of them had reported it to the authorities. It's just absolutely terrifying to think that if they hadn't have been so arrogant and complacent and thought that they were smarter than the cops, they so could have easily gotten away with Kimberly's murder and the attack on Jamie, which we all know means that they would 100% have gone on to kill more innocent people. Once in the station, three of the boys actually started talking almost immediately. It was only Chris Scribble that held out for hours claiming his innocence, telling police that his knowledge of the crime was purely what he'd seen on the 6 o'clock news, before finally breaking down and bizarrely, his ended up being one of the most detailed confessions out of the lot.
You said something to the effect of, now we write up a warrant for your arrest. And I asked him on what charge. Somehow in there, he brought up the idea that I was going to get charged with murder and probably capital murder. I didn't understand what capital murder was. They had referred to the death penalty before, but I didn't make the connection at that point, so I asked him what capital murder was.
Now, you said they. Was that in the part of the interview we were talking about
earlier? Yes, that was in a part of the interview earlier. They had mentioned something about the death penalty. I don't remember the exact reference.
Okay. So the part of the interview where you were saying, I didn't do this, I didn't have any involvement with Fort Trowell Road, some mention of the death penalty was made.
Yes.
Okay. So then back to what was happening
during this conversation with John. He explained to me that capital murder carried a death penalty. And at that point, I was like, death penalty? And I sort of sat thinking about that for a little while. That was when the point when I mean, he didn't seem to have anything else to do. He was just kind of sitting there. He walked back and forth a couple times inside the room. I started talking about, like, my family and stuff. And how I hadn't had such a good childhood and explaining some of the things that had happened. Not sure why I started talking about it. I mean, it was just, I was starting to feel kind of like, Well, some of the things they said when I was telling them I didn't have anything to do with it, some of them had kind of cued me into somebody who was saying something. They'd mentioned things that set me off, there's some things you can infer from a crime scene that I could tell they could infer from it. There are some things that I knew were lies that I had heard them say. And there were other things that hit way too close to the mark that they couldn't know without somebody saying something. Like how Billy had not been able to get out of the basement. That's something that you can't infer from the crime scene, to my mind. And there were other things. They mentioned something about, did we go out and bury something? That specifically hit me. And I was thinking about that while John was walking around the room during that break. Because, as I remembered, only me and Steve knew that we'd buried the weapons. And if he was saying things, then they could have everything. So it didn't really matter at that point. I was like, well, if they give me the death penalty, then I'll just be dead and this all will be over with anyway. So be like killing myself. So at that point, I was kind of like, you know what, John, why don't you get your tape recorder? And he came back in. He was all excited. Brought the tape recorder back in, and that's when I told them exactly what happened in pretty much the same way I told you here. He asked a bunch of questions about it, specific details that he wanted to go back over. Just pretty much laid out everything that happened for him.
And just to be clear for the jury, the conversation that we're talking about this break, that wasn't recorded.
No, that was not recorded at all.
And then you said, go get your tape recorder. And so Yes. Then when you went into the details of what happened, that was recorded.
Yes, that was recorded.
I don't know about you, but just hearing him gave me chills. He is just so eloquent and composed and so unbothered. Like, literally, there is no emotion. If you go to our Facebook discussion group, you'll have the link so you can actually see him. And there's just no emotion. It really is quite terrifying. During his confession to the police, it turns out that there was actually a fifth teen involved. A boy by the name of Autumn Savoy. Now, although he wasn't there with them on that night, his job was to provide them all with a predetermined alibi, saying that they were at his house during whatever time they told him, if or when he ever got questioned by authorities. He was also the one who helped them get rid of evidence, throwing items in a nearby lake when the others told him to. Now, Autumn had a lot to say about the teen that he had known the longest, and that was Stephen. He said that Stevie would love to tell violent stories as if they were true, but it usually ended up not being true. So although he agreed to be their alibi, he hadn't actually believed that they'd carried out the attack. And it wasn't until he started seeing reports about it on the news, specifically the fact that Jamie Cates had survived the attack, that he started getting nervous. And just to make you more sick in the stomach, Chris's sister was about the same age as Jamie, so how had he not seen his sister's face while he was attacking her? Chris told investigators that his only regret about the whole ordeal was the fact that Jamie had survived. And the reason that he wished she hadn't survived was for her own good. He explained that dealing with all the trauma that she would face as a result of the attack is something that nobody should go through. And I mean, in a way, he's right, but hey, buddy, how about we don't go around killing people to begin with? That's just the most messed up logic. 19-year-old Chris was described by people that knew him as having a loving upbringing, with multiple witnesses praising his parents for their dedication to giving their kids a good life. And even when Chris had shown signs of being a troubled teen, they had tried hard to help. Chris, though, told a very different story of his childhood. He accused his mum of being very abusive, so much so that multiple friends of Chris remember him saying that he wanted to kill his mum. Chris gave an example of the abuse he suffered. His mum had pinned him down and began popping acne and other sores on his back, threatening him not to move while she did it. And I'm a little conflicted on whether that's abusive enough to want to kill over. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that pinning your child down is right by any means, but there are kids that are having the living daylights beaten out of them, and they aren't out there murdering. Chris was also homeschooled from a young age, and blamed his homeschooling for the murders, saying that he just wanted to fit in and finally belong. And these are all the most pathetic excuses, as far as I'm concerned. His dad talked about Chris's high intelligence, but he and others all agreed that Chris was socially awkward and had a hard time catching on to social cues. Going back to how I really feel like his excuses are a reach, especially the homeschooling one, it wasn't like he was isolated. He was involved in the Boy Scouts throughout his life. So that completely negates the not belonging again, in my opinion, because the Boy Scouts is a complete community, a tight-knit community as well, and especially as he'd met Stephen Spader through both of them being Boy Scouts. Chris's mum, Tamara Gribble, testified in court at his trial and gave her version of Chris's upbringing. She said that she only remembers hitting Chris one time when he was 5 years old, and when she spanked him, the wooden spoon she was using broke. She carried on saying that she put the remnants of that wooden spoon in her bedroom in the top drawer of her dresser as a reminder to herself to never lose control like that again. When asked what had prompted the spanking, she told the court that instead of 5-year-old Chris coming inside to use the toilet while he was outside playing, he instead wet himself in his clothes and kept on playing. He had ruined a pair of shoes already this way, and Tamara was fed up with cleaning urine out of his shoes. When she told him off, he allegedly told her to just buy him new shoes. Irrespective of whether we believe Chris's version of his upbringing or Tamara's version is frankly irrelevant in this instance, because none of what either of them said justifies what Chris and his buddies did. Around the time that Chris was 16, he was reprimanded at church for inappropriately touching one of his peers. Chris's parents were ordered to send him to counselling to work through whatever internal issues he was having. And it was during one of these counselling sessions that Chris would confess for the first documented time, so not just to his friends, that he regularly dreamed of killing his mum. Although he'd seen a couple of different therapists, none of them were willing to provide ongoing treatment, even though they all agreed that he needed it. The therapist that Chris had made the threat against Tamara's life to did contact her as a formality and said that yes, he'd said those things, but she didn't believe Chris to be a danger to her or anyone else. But she did have to let her know the conversation as per state law. Tamara said that Chris's therapist had said that the threat was nothing more than any average teenager that gets upset with their parent would say. And I'm not entirely sure about that, because I'm sure a lot of you listening will agree that when we've been mad with our parents, we've either said, I hate you, to their face or behind their back. But I, for one, don't ever remember wanting my mum dead, or at least for me killing her. I don't know, does that seem like the average teenage anger in your opinion? Despite his alleged social awkwardness, throughout his interrogation, you wouldn't necessarily know, because Chris seemed to have a pretty high opinion of himself and was able to dodge the investigators' questions well. But when the confession came, it was a cold and callous one. He spoke about the murder in great detail, but minimising his role at every opportunity, implicating Stephen. Stephen had been born in 1991, and he wasn't your typical troubled boy. He wasn't from an abusive family, and he hadn't committed murder just to fit in. Stephen was adopted when he was about 5 days old by loving parents who gave him nothing but love and opportunity in life. His birth mother had substance abuse problems, and Stephen had tested positive for marijuana and cocaine from the minute he was born. He was definitely not socially awkward like Chris, and he never spoke of any abuse or hatred of his parents. In a medical evaluation leading up to his trial, no major mental illness was diagnosed, and nor was there any evidence of narcissistic personality traits, borderline personality, or antisocial traits. So if we categorise criminals into mad or bad, it seems Stephen would definitely just fall into the bad category. The prosecutor assigned to the case categorised Stephen as nothing less than a psychopath. During his interrogation, Chris Gribble said, quote, Steve just lost it and started hacking away at the lady, end quote. And the lady obviously being Kimberly Cates. And while both Chris and Stephen committed the murder, Stephen definitely seemed to be the ringleader behind the entire thing, which means it'll come as no surprise to you that he was also the common denominator of the group. The only reason the group was together that day was because of Stephen Spader. He had created the gang, or the Disciples of Destruction, as I told you earlier they were called. And this crime was actually the initiation into his new gang. Commit a robbery, killing anyone in the home during the process, and you would be a bona fide member. All four of these kids admitted that the attack was random, purely done for the thrill of it, and a way to prove themselves tough enough to be initiated into the Disciples of Destruction. So who were the other two boys? We've discussed Stephen and Chris. You'll remember William Marks, known as Billy, as the skinny one who had gone through the tiny window and then thought that he was trapped. Well, everyone who knew Billy, including his dad, described him as being a misfit and an insecure teenager who was struggling to fit in. His dad said that he'd been worried that Billy was hanging out with the wrong crowd and had told him as much, but it fell on deaf ears. It was Billy who had gone with Stephen to scout out which homes to burglarise, and together they chose Trail Road in Mount Vernon because of how secluded it was. Now, while Billy played a lesser role in the death of Kimberly and the assault of Jamie, it doesn't lessen his guilt, in my opinion. Billy, along with Quinn, had stood at the entryway of the master bedroom, as we said, and simply watched. Not stopping or attempting to stop your deranged friends or trying to save either of the victims in some way after the wounds were inflicted is as good as striking the blows yourself. And what about Quinn Glover? Even though he told investigators during his interrogation that, yes, he was a bit upset about the attack against the Cates, and he'd actually even said to Chris, no women, no children. But just like Billy, he did nothing to stop the attack or even help them after the attack. And there's actually very little on the internet about Quinn regarding his upbringing or just anything about him, really. And on to the fifth member of this crime, Autumn Savoy. As we said, he wasn't present during the actual attack, but he had provided the alibi and helped dispose of the evidence by dumping the bloody clothing in the Nashua River. He pleaded guilty to conspiracy and hindering apprehension and was sentenced to 5 to 12 years in prison. He made a parole attempt in September of 2014, which was denied by the parole board on the grounds that Autumn needed to come up with a better post-release plan. The board wasn't happy with the living arrangements that he had in place at the time because his mum had said that she wasn't comfortable with him coming back home to live with her at that point. But in May of 2015, she changed her mind. Autumn reapplied and this time was granted release. His light sentence did cause a lot of controversy in the local area because he was back roaming amongst them all pretty quickly. In exchange for testifying against Chris and Stephen in their trials, Quinn was given a sentence of 20 to 40 years. As I said earlier, although he didn't physically attack Kimberly or Jamie, he did nothing to stop it. So he was found guilty on 3 counts of burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary, and accomplice to first-degree assault, all to be served consecutively. And I just want to pause here quickly because I know from my TikTok comments, a lot of times people get confused with what concurrent sentence and consecutive sentences mean. So when you hear someone that has, say, been sentenced to 2 counts of 20 years to be served concurrently, it doesn't mean 40 years. It means that those 20 years are just served at the same time. They start at the same time and are served at the same time. So they're only serving 20 years. Whereas consecutively is one after the other. So in this made up scenario of, say, 2 counts of 20 years, they would then serve 40. So Quinn's first prison stint was for the burglary charge. And he very quickly applied for parole and said, I cannot express how terrible I feel about what I've done. And it worked because the parole board accepted his application and said that they were impressed with Quinn's record in prison, saying to him that it appears that you have been making substantial progress and have been of no disciplinary concerns. The board's decision meant that Quinn started serving his next sentence immediately from that point. And the earliest that he could make parole on that is this year, 2024. 19-year-old Billy Marks pleaded guilty to burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary, and accomplice to first-degree assault, and was sentenced to 30 to 60 years behind bars. He is eligible for parole on the first of those three charges again this year in 2024. Chris's trial wasn't scheduled to begin until February of 2011, but in early December 2010, he surprised the court by pleading not guilty, by reason of insanity, but he did admit to the crimes. He said that he had wanted to kill someone for a long time and was disappointed that he didn't feel any emotion following Kimberly's death. A medical evaluation, though, showed no mental illness, and he was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge in his case saying, "Infinity is not enough jail time." He is currently being held at the New Hampshire State Prison for Men. He has also reportedly had multiple physical run-ins with fellow inmates and was placed in the special housing unit, where he has limited to no contact with other inmates for long periods of time. Stephen Spader was found guilty on 2 counts of first-degree murder, guilty of attempted murder, guilty of conspiracy to murder, guilty of conspiracy to burglary, and guilty of witness tampering. And he was sentenced to life without parole and an additional 76 years for the attempted murder of Jamie Cates. But he was required to be resentenced under a US Supreme Court ruling that threw out mandatory life in prison without parole for juveniles. The court held that children couldn't automatically be punished the same way as criminal adults without considering their age and other factors. I just want to go back to his initial sentencing hearing, though, because it was actually held on his birthday, and Stephen could be heard asking his attorney if he thought that the jury would sing him happy birthday. Ugh. To me, that not only shows a lack of maturity, but also a complete disconnection from the case and how serious the charges against him were. A video of him asking that question will be available on our Facebook discussion group. He didn't appear in court for his resentencing, but he did send an apology letter to the Cates for his counsel to read in court. And this will shock you. He asked that his original sentence be upheld. I'm pretty sure no one has ever done that. Like, they have possibly got a get out of jail free card here. I'm pretty sure no one has ever said, no, keep me in prison. But that is exactly what Stephen said. Part of the letter said that he did not want to slip by on some technicality and insisting that he wanted to take responsibility for his actions. In the letter, he describes himself as the most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet, before going on to apologise for killing Kimberly Cates. And the Cates family were actually beyond insulted by this letter and were relieved when his original sentence was upheld. The judge made each of the sentences consecutive to one another and added her reason. She said, "To ensure that you stay in that cage for the rest of your pointless life." And as far as thrill kills go, this case is definitely up there with one of the most heinous I've heard. Literally carried out for kicks. They killed simply because there were people out there in the world that they could kill. And the town of Mount Vernon is forever changed. Residents now double lock their doors, many have guard dogs and either a gun or an axe that they keep on their nightstands in the event of an intruder. Because those four boys left people thinking that callous murders and random attacks are now the norm. Now in her early 20s, Jamie Cates has not let her attack and her mother's murder stop her. Every year, the Kimberly Cates Scholarship Tournament takes place in honour of her mum. And Jamie says the event is not about the attack, but instead about love, community, and healing. She graduated from college and was quoted as saying that she is now just living every day like it's her last. To see today's case photos and videos, click on the link in the case description to join the Cup of Coffee and Crime Facebook discussion group. Until next week, stay safe.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.